It is Tuesday, November 19th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 33rd season of entertainment presents the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Jazz Band and Jazz Cats Tuesday, November 19th, that's tonight at 7:30, in the Fort Smith Convention Center. This band and vocal ensemble combine to perform vintage to contemporary high-energy jazz. Tickets and more information are available at uafs.edu.
And KUAF is supported by Go Calendars, Games, Toys, and Books, located in the Sears Wing of the Northwest Arkansas Mall. Go Calendars, Games, Toys, and Books features holiday gifts and gift ideas for everyone, including the young at heart.
On this edition of Ozarks, a spare budget, a stark story, and a love of Arkansas locations are ingredients for a new movie called Come Morning. The Northwest Arkansas premiere is in a few weeks, and later we'll hear from the film's creator.
Plus a preview of GIS Day, how creating maps has changed in just the past 30 years, and how the Earth changed 10,000 years ago. Michael Jokum offers a preview of his talk tonight about the end of the last ice age and how the planet changed.
But first, all parties in the long-standing desegregation case involving three central Arkansas school districts have agreed to a settlement first proposed last week. According to Talk Business Arkansas, the Little Rock School District last night signed off on the agreement after the North Little Rock and Pulaski County Special School Districts had already agreed to the settlement. As part of the agreement, the state will pay the districts a total of $65.8 million for the next four fiscal years. The first 3 years would see Little Rock receiving $37.3 million from the state, North Little Rock getting $7.6 million, and Pulaski County getting $20.8 million. In the fourth year, the money would be earmarked for facilities construction projects in the three districts.
Though Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel has approved two proposed medical marijuana ballot initiatives for signature gathering, yesterday he denied another proposed marijuana measure. This initiative in question, submitted by retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Marjorie LeClaire of Shirley, called for the state constitution to be amended to repeal all laws pertaining to production, distribution, and sale of cannabis and cannabis-derived products. The proposed ballot initiative was rejected because of ambiguities in the measure's text.
The expansion project at the Rogers Historical Museum recently received a boost with some state funding. State Representative Les Carmine presented Rogers Mayor Greg Hines and Museum Director John Burroughs with $100,000 of state general improvement funds. Burroughs says the state grant will help the museum match other grants for which it has been approved.
The Rogers Historical Museum received a National Endowment for the Humanities grant is a 3-to-1 matching grant. It's a $500,000 grant from NEH. We're in the process of working through our matches. We've accomplished all of our matches to date, actually for 2013. So this money will be applied to the 2014 match. And once we get to the end of the process, we'll have raised $1.5 million.
Burroughs says the match required for the NEH grant will increase incrementally through 2017.
The 2014 match is $150,000, so the money that Mr. Carnine helped secure for us, that's already two-thirds of the match for 2013, and we're looking at some other sources that will hopefully help us accomplish that match before we even in 2013. The 2015 match is $300,000, and then the 2016 match is $900,000. We're already actually working on those. We have some other grant sources that we're pursuing, some private foundations and local donors.
Before construction of the expansion can begin, though, Burroughs says the museum will need to raise about $5 million of the $7.9 million total cost of the project.
A new report by the Delta Quality Campaign, or DQC, highlights the work done in Arkansas to improve student achievement through the use of educational data. The DQC is a nonpartisan national advocacy group, and its recent state-by-state analysis placed Arkansas and Delaware as the national leaders in using data to improve education. The report offers new details about the way Arkansas elected officials, teachers, and school administrators have instituted data-sharing policies that aid student performance in early childhood education, K through 12, and post-secondary schools. Amy Gudera oversees the work of the DQC.
For too long, stakeholders in education were making decisions by hunch and by anecdote, and what always they felt like worked in the past or didn't work, or just what felt like it was going to work. And the power of data, as I mentioned, is transformative because now policymakers can make decisions based on what actually is working, what they know is working, but also empowering parents and teachers with information that's tailored to them about their own specific child or kids in their classroom changes everything.
Gudera says the ability to tailor and personalize learning is the exciting part of using the educational data. She says Arkansas is a prime example of a state where leaders increasingly recognize that empowering parents, educators, and policymakers with the right data at the right time in the right format better ensures young people graduate from high school prepared for post-secondary education and careers.
The State Highway and Transportation Department is launching a new website it says will help drivers avoid areas of major congestion along Arkansas's roadways. According to spokesman Danny Straisley, iDriveArkansas.com has been in development since January.
Basically, it's a map-based website that shows people where all of the construction zones are located on the state highway system. They can click on a traffic layer that shows a live representation of how the traffic is flowing to and through those construction zones.
Straisley says the department also hopes to soon add traffic cameras along interstates for online viewing and a winter weather road conditions map. He also reminds listeners they can follow the highway department on Twitter by following @AHTD for real-time traffic updates.
And the State Highway Department has announced lane closures will begin tonight on Interstate 540 in Fayetteville from 8 p.m. until 7 p.m. From 8 p.m. till 7 a.m., the inside northbound and southbound lanes will be closed between Porter and Weddington Roads so crews can install a concrete barrier in the median. The project is expected to take up to 4 nights to complete, though weather or other unforeseen conditions could result in an adjustment of closure times. The barrier is part of the larger $16.6 million project to add third lanes to the interstate between the Porter and Weddington exits.
After claiming its third NCAA South Central Regional title in a row, the University of Arkansas women's cross-country team held the number 3 spot in the U.S. Track and Field Association's coaches' poll yesterday before the 2013 NCAA National Championship meet. The Razorbacks scored 33 points in the meet to earn the largest margin of victory in the NCAA South Central Regional en route to the program's 18th regional title. The Razorbacks will return to the course for the final meet of the season on Saturday in Terre Haute, Indiana. The women's 6K is scheduled to start at 12:15 p.m.
And after taking the team title at the 2013 NCAA South Central Regional Championships last week, the University of Arkansas men's cross-country team is now ranked number 10 in that same coaches' poll. By winning the regional, the Razorbacks clinch a spot in the 2013 NCAA National Championship meet in Terre Haute. The men's championship race is scheduled for an 11 a.m. start on Saturday.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions with lows around 37 degrees. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a slight chance of afternoon showers in northwest Arkansas and highs around 60 degrees. Tomorrow night, expect cloudy conditions with a 70% chance of showers in northwest Arkansas, a 50% chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley, and lows around 50 degrees.
This is Ozarks at Large. In about 20 minutes on the program, a movie filmed in Arkansas with a dark story. We'll learn more about Come Morning and its Northwest Arkansas debut in Rogers early next month. That's ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has issued its final ruling on a long-anticipated federal insurance parity law, which ends discrimination against mental health. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
According to the National Institute of Mental Health, 26% of Americans age 18 and older, 1 in 4 adults, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder. In any given year, nearly 60 million individuals. On October 8th, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius announced at a National Mental Health Care Symposium in Washington, D.C., that access to mental health care for such individuals will now be more accessible and more affordable. The ruling comes at the end of a 5-year-long vetting of the Mental Health Parity Act of 2008 and mandates that all insurance providers will now be required to cover behavioral health as they do physical health. Kim Arnold is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Health Arkansas, based in Little Rock. The private nonprofit organization assists Arkansans living with mental illness, their families, and community.
Well, it was definitely cause for celebration. And the reason for that is because we've been waiting for a very long time for those, and it's been, you know, it's a 20, the regulations we've been waiting for, it's a result of a 20-year bipartisan campaign by individuals and families that are affected by mental illness to end, well, unfair discrimination that led to this whole enactment of the Parity and Addiction Act. And so finally having rules and implementing that, that's, you have to have those in order to comply. And so we owe a lot of thanks to that, but so we're very excited that now we have rules that we can go by and actually have those regulations in place.
The ruling states that insurance provider health plans must feature copays, deductibles, and visits equitable to medical surgical benefits. Other consumer protections include equitable residential treatment and intensive outpatient coverage.
And it requires insurers to provide mental health care benefits on the same terms that they cover physical illnesses. And that's very important. The thing that it doesn't do, and we still have a way to go, is that it doesn't say anything yet about the regulations, I should say, don't apply to managed care plans through Medicaid or through CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that, for Arkansas, those are some of our most vulnerable people.
However, individuals enrolling in expanded Medicaid in Arkansas signing up for private insurance under the private option, according to email correspondence for this report from Alice Jones at the Arkansas Insurance Department, will be subject to the mental health care parity rule. Kim Arnold says she and her colleagues will be pushing for mental health care parity to extend to those currently enrolled in traditional Medicaid outside of the Affordable Care Act. Pam Christie is executive director of the Mental Health Council of Arkansas. MHCA assists and represents 15 member community mental health centers across the state, including a children's center and a residential facility for severely mentally ill.
Well, obviously, when I got the word this week, we were thrilled that the final ruling had been done. And, you know, our hope all along is to have parity for folks with behavioral health issues. And, you know, we have dealt with, we still continue to deal with stigma. That's a concern in terms of people continuing to go seek treatment so that the parity can obviously level the playing field. But to get people to continue to go is something that we will also always work towards. We work with our consumers. We just finished a consumer council conference and work on reducing stigma as much as we can to get people into treatment. And so we were thrilled as a council about the parity and about seeing the final ruling.
The push to finalize a mental health parity law came as a result of efforts by the Obama administration to both reduce gun violence and the stigma of mental illness. The Affordable Care Act requires coverage of mental health and substance abuse disorder services as one of 10 essential health benefit categories. Under the essential health benefits rule, individual and small group health plans are required to comply with these parity regulations. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For a long time, the sound of preparing for travel was this. A map unfolding, possibly never to return to that crisp, flat rectangle it was before you opened it. Or maybe, with a little bit more cash, the sound of travel was pages of an atlas flipping. Now it's likely that your guide is electronic.
Starting route to 1109 Northeast Wood Drive. Head south on South School Avenue.
Even if you do still prefer the paper version of a map, you've probably used GIS or Geographic Information Systems technology in just the past few days. The ease with which GIS information has become available for researchers and laypeople alike means maps of all kinds, not just tools designed to get from here to there, can be made and shared. Some of those concepts will be shared tomorrow on the University of Arkansas campus as part of GIS Day and International Observance. Kate Dougherty is Geosciences and Maps Librarian at the University of Arkansas.
The beauty of GIS is that while we've had maps for thousands of years now, with the GIS we can take different maps with different pieces of information about the same location and overlay them in a GIS. And that allows us to see things from a different perspective and query information and those maps in terms of their spatial relationships to each other. So, for example, you could have a layer or a GIS layer of flood zones and a layer of land parcels, and you could overlay those and query for the land parcels that fall within the flood zones, and you could create a new map from that information and customize it and share it with others.
Spend just a few minutes spooling through Facebook and Twitter feeds, and you'll find maps that show where campaign spending per capita is highest or where more people say soda rather than pop. Tomorrow from 10 until 4 on the first floor of Mullins Library on the U of A campus, there will be demonstrations about how GIS technology has helped disciplines like political science, agriculture, even art history develop informational maps. Kate Dougherty says in the past 3 decades, the resources needed to take advantage of GIS information have become less expensive and more available.
And it's really become democratized, I think, in the past few years, in the sense that before it involved very expensive software and a steep learning curve, and that's not true anymore. So now there are a profusion of free and easy-to-use GIS and mapping websites and geolocation tools that allow pretty much anyone to get involved, and that's what we're trying to show and encourage during our event on Wednesday.
The sessions tomorrow range from the academic to the fun. Students can participate in a GIS-related scavenger hunt. GIS tools and technologies are frequently used in smartphone apps for geocaching or retail-related sites. The app Scavenger is a multi-million-dollar application used for everything from social networking to selling cars.
It's a game that allows you to check in at certain places and you complete challenges. So, for example, you could check in at a certain restaurant and it would have a challenge to do origami with your napkin or your paper menu. And you snap a picture of it and then you earn points for that. So it's sort of similar to other apps, but it's GIS or it's location enabled, so it knows where you are and it immediately will show you the challenges that are available and you earn points for doing those and then you win prizes at the company.
And Kate Dougherty says the democratization of GIS technology brings with it a familiar dilemma: how to know when to trust a map or other source of information developed with digitized information.
That's very true, and that's true of information in general, which is definitely an issue for librarians trying to help people figure out what is valid information and trusted information versus what may not be. And that's definitely true of GIS layers as well. There's a lot of information out there, and especially with crowdsourcing now happening, there are issues with data quality. One of the issues is metadata. So is that information documented, and who created it, and what's the spatial accuracy? And who to contact for more information.
Kate Dougherty is Geosciences and Maps Librarian at the University of Arkansas. Tomorrow, Mullins Library on the university campus will host GIS Day at the library in room 104 beginning at 10 a.m. You can see a schedule and learn much more at libinfo.uark.edu.
This is Ozarks at Large. Ozark Regional Transit is offering free fare days for the upcoming holiday season. Bus fare for all fixed route transit buses will be free of charge on November 29th, the day after Thanksgiving, and again the week of December 26th through the 31st, the week after Christmas. ORT fixed routes run past multiple shopping areas, and many have transfer stops at the Northwest Arkansas Mall, the Promenade, as well as area Walmart and Harp stores. On-demand and paratransit routes will remain at the current fare rates.
The holiday season officially begins in Bentonville with the lighting of the square. That will be Saturday, November 23rd. There will be festivities throughout the day on the downtown Bentonville Square, including the Girls on the Run of Northwest Arkansas Race and the Miss Winter Wonderland Pageant. Lighting of the Square festivities begin at 4 in the afternoon on the Walton Arts Center main stage on the downtown Bentonville Square. The lights will be turned on at 6 when Mayor Bob McCaslin officially flips the switch. The lighting of the square is followed by the Christmas tree lighting at the ice rink at Lawrence Plaza. That takes place at 6:30 Saturday.
The Fayetteville Visitors Bureau has announced that the annual Lights of the Ozarks Lighting Night Parade will be held at 6 o'clock November 23rd. That's this Saturday. And this year, the route has been expanded to include Block Avenue and Dixon Street. The parade, always held on the Saturday before Thanksgiving, will begin at the Fayetteville Public Library and will head east on Mountain, north on East Avenue, west on Center Street, north on Block, west on Dixon Street, and south on West Avenue, ending back at the library. The decision comes after the Fayetteville City Council voted in August to expand the lights of the Ozarks to include sidewalk street lamps wrapped with LED lighted garlands on Block Avenue and light pole fixtures that hang over the sidewalks on Dixon Street.
Those were up this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I drove to work. Some of them are...
Saw them on last night.
Yeah, I bet you did. And the Greater Eureka Springs Chamber of Commerce has announced that members of the world-famous Platters will serve as the Grand Marshal of the annual Christmas parade in that town. That's Friday, December 6th at 6 p.m. Theme for the 2013 Eureka Springs Parade is Christmas Memories. The parade is staged in the historic downtown district, and the Basin Spring Park area will be decorated and will serve as the staging area for parade announcers and judges.
Publishers are marking the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination with a flood of new books. One includes all 486 frames of the famous Zapruder film in print for the first time.
It won't put to rest anything, but if you do want to see what happened, this is it.
Kennedy Books, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen today from 3 to 6 p.m. to KUAF Public Radio.
This is Ozarks at Large. Let's go into the past for just a few minutes. About 2.3 million years ago, the Pleistocene epoch began more than 2 million years ago and brought with it years, centuries, millennia of varying climate to the planet, alternating cooling and warming trends. The last cooling period, the last ice age, ended about 10,000 years ago as sea levels rose and hunters and gatherers were forced to alter their lives. Michael Jokum, a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has been studying Central Europe at the time of the end of the last ice age, and will discuss his work tonight on the University of Arkansas campus as part of this academic year's Stigler Lecture Series. This morning, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at KUAF to talk about his presentation. I asked him if we know much about how people 10,000 years ago were affected by a dramatic switch in climate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think very definitely. And this is not just reflecting any work I've done, but German colleagues all over the area have been doing work like this, more often in caves than in lake edges, for example. But, yeah, we have a very good handle, number one, on the vegetational changes from a lot of pollen studies that have been preserved, seeing how the whole environment changed at the end of the Ice Age from, well, first of all, from a polar desert, essentially with very few plants at all, to a tundra similar to the high Arctic tundras today, but mixed with grasses and steppe elements. And then gradually trees moving in as the climate became warmer. You first see transition into sort of a pine birch forest that became pretty monotonous. And then gradually trees like oak and maple moved in and the forest became denser but also more varied. And, yeah, with that pollen background that's well-dated now, we can monitor the environmental changes. And then the challenge is to match archaeological evidence with that to see what corresponded, what happened when these forests closed. How did people deal with it? And that's really the focus of my talk here. Big environment transformation. What does the archaeological record tell us? And it tells us there were big changes in people's behavior, basically.
Can you give me one example of, I mean...
All right. Well, the archaeological record we know shows that during the period when it was still cold, still open tundras, people were hunting reindeer, primarily, wild horses to some extent. They were able to predict pretty well where the reindeer would migrate, set up big camps, and these big camps could last through from fall through into winter, possibly into spring. And apparently a lot was going on besides killing reindeer, because we have lots of what we call art objects, carvings and engravings on bone and antler, lots of jewelry and the like, turning up in these sites where lots of people apparently were camping. All of that disappears virtually in the next period when we've got closed forests. There are no big sites of virtually nothing that we'd call art, or objects of jewelry or adornment. It all disappears, and it looks like a cultural decline, but I think what better word would be adjustment.
The sea levels would change, right? I mean,
sea levels definitely change.
You had glaciers that were in northern Europe across Scandinavia,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And if they were melting.
The Alps, they were melting, sea levels rose. I'm far enough away from the coast that that's a very indirect influence on my area. But certainly as sea levels change and the ice melted, we also see changes in ocean currents. And for example, the Gulf Stream, back in the Ice Age, it didn't flow up to Scandinavia the way it does. That warm water didn't go up there. It came straight across the Atlantic, about the level of Spain, the latitude of Spain. And everything north of that was much colder. And gradually, the Gulf Stream formed as climate warmed, and that had an influence, especially on the sort of the Atlantic fringe of Europe, warming it, making it much more maritime, less continental, less extremes of temperature.
You mentioned the vegetation change, the wildlife change as well.
Absolutely. Those reindeer didn't last very long. And they were replaced by more solitary animals like moose and deer, red deer, which are like our elk. Wild horses stayed around for a while. And then as the forest sort of progressed and developed and succeeded, then we have things like wild boar and smaller deer species and the little fur-bearing animals like marten and lynx and things like that. So, yeah, big changes.
Did that mean a change in the food supply?
It had to. Yeah. It had to. And one of the big questions, still pretty outstanding and unanswered, is the role of plant foods. Because the variety of plants increased. A number of these were edible. And the main change we see is the appearance of lots and lots of hazelnuts at sites around 8,000, 7,000 years ago, indicating that at least that seems to have been a big focus, adding to the diet.
Our climate is changing now.
Yeah, apparently.
How fair is it to apply anything we have in the archaeological record to contemporary times?
I've been asked that. And certainly the lessons from archaeology of this period, I don't think are applicable at all, because these were people who lived at very low density. They were hunting and gathering, not producing their own food, moving around a lot. And the way they could respond was so different from what we can do today. The lessons might be that big changes can affect behavior tremendously and have to, and that they can happen rapidly. So that's the only lesson I can see.
Michael Jokum is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and will discuss the last ice age in Central Europe tonight at 6:30 in Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus. His presentation is part of the 2013-2014 Stigler Lecture Series in Anthropology.
This is Ozarks at Large. Derek Sims has always wanted to make movies. After graduating from high school, he traveled along a career path that has allowed him to do just that. The Kingsland, Arkansas native graduated with a degree in mass media from Henderson State University in 2007 before moving to Rogers to teach film at the Northwest Arkansas Academy of Fine Arts. Sims credits reading a lot of books and watching the special features on the Lord of the Rings extended cut DVDs as his film school. Sims and his wife eventually moved to Los Angeles and even created their own production company, Fabled Motion Pictures. The couple has been working on movies for the past few years and moved back to Rogers about a month ago. Over the course of the next few weeks, they will be hosting screenings of their film Come Morning across the state. The film was shot in 12 days and has been shown at a couple of film festivals, including the Oxford Film Festival, where it won Best Cinematography. The film will make its Arkansas debut tomorrow in Monticello, but Northwest Arkansas residents can catch a screening of Come Morning December 5th at Rogers Malco Town Cinema. Late last week, Derek Sims, the film's writer, director, editor, and cinematographer, stopped by Studio 123 to discuss Come Morning. During the conversation, he said the movie's premise came to him while he was a camera operator at a local TV station.
I was actually working at 4029 when I came up with the idea for Come Morning. I was driving there one night. I think it was a late night shift. And I just thought about me and my grandpa when I was a kid. We used to go hunting together. My dad and my brother, they didn't want to hunt with me or him because we talk too much and don't sit still. We're terrible hunters, you know. We never killed anything. It's just we just walked out there together and sat for a couple hours and then got bored and went home. but no, I was just kind of reminiscing on that, and it was, I think it was around that time of year, maybe like October or November, something like that. And I don't know, just this, I guess, sort of weird, demented part of my mind said, you know, what if there's this grandpa and this grandson and they shot their neighbor and he was down there? And so there's this whole sort of general idea of they shot their neighbor and you know, and they got to go hide the body kind of thing kind of popped in my mind. I was like, that's an interesting story. I think you could make that film, and you can make it fairly inexpensively, and I have all the locations and everything, because and that's another reason we shot in Kingsland, because it's like, I know everyone there. I can get all these locations for free, and it'll be simple. So that's where that whole idea kind of spurned from, and I called one of my producer friends, and I said, what do you think about this? And just told him a few lines. He said, yeah, you should write that down and flesh it out and see what you come up with. And so for the next, you know, 3 weeks or so, I think something that sort of also helped spurn the idea for Come Morning was I just finished reading Cormac McCarthy's The Road. And at the time that I came up with the idea, I was reading First Blood by Dave Morrell, which was the first Rambo story. And so both of these are these survival stories. And even The Road has, you know, a father and a son, you know, traveling down the road, which is Come Morning is a grandpa and their grandson traveling down the road. They just happen to be carrying a dead body. I just kind of like this sort of survival tale on a very small level, you know, like two people surviving, or like in Rambo's case, it was one person surviving out in the woods, all of these people hunted after him, you know. And so I like that idea, and so I think, you know, all those elements combined, sort of, that's what Come Morning became.
And it's set in Arkansas.
It's set in Arkansas. It's set in the 1970s, mm-hmm. which...
Why?
It was set in the 1970s for a few reasons. One is because hunting is not the same now as it was back then. And I wasn't born in the 70s. I was born in the 80s. So I think the 70s, I guess in my mind, it's more of a romantic period. There were a lot of great films that came out in the 70s. I like the way the vehicles look in the 70s. I like a lot about it. And I definitely didn't want to put it in modern times, because you have cell phones, you know, and it's like, well, why don't they just call someone, you know? The 70s still kind of feels a little bit far removed, you know, in communications time and things like that. I just really like the idea of the 70s, and maybe because I wasn't born there. I'm not really sure. I've never really thought about that a whole lot. I just liked, you know, also the clothing styles. I really liked it. And something else, too, like hunting attire, you know, minus like really modern kind of things, the hunting attire in South Arkansas is pretty much the same attire as you would wear in the 70s, so I knew that we could costume it fairly easily, you know, and just flannel shirts and blue jeans kind of thing. So, but a really cool thing is one of the actors who's in the film, he was one of the only local actors we brought on, but he had an Arkansas license plate with 1974 expiration tags on it, which the film takes place in 73, so naturally it would be a 74 tag, and he never got them replaced. And so we took his, and that's the license plate in the movie, because it's prominently featured at the very end of the movie. And so that was really cool that he just happened to have that in his shed.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I understand why you said it in Arkansas. Why did you go ahead and shoot it in Arkansas when you could have shot it somewhere else?
Well, I shot it in Arkansas because... I shot it in Kingsland because, like, I just knew a lot of people there. Mm-hmm. And whenever I wrote it, I actually imagined it taking place geographically in the place, you know, like, here's where me and my grandpa hunted. That's where it starts off. It goes to the bottom of the hill. It climbs up the hill. It goes down the road. It comes back. You know, I kind of had this geography, you know, planned out, even though we didn't shoot in those places, except for one location. But all the rest of them were, you know, kind of spread out. We tried to find locations that looked good. Rather than just mm-hmm. following the geography of the land. But I wanted it in Arkansas because I feel like movies never really capture the South very well. There are a few, but I think overall they miss something, you know, whether it's accents, whether it's culture, you know, whatever it is. It just hardly ever feels right. And so you hardly ever see Arkansas on the screen. Other than Jeff Nichols, there's really no one. David Gordon Green did a couple of films about Arkansas, but other than that, there's really not a whole lot. But I wanted the Arkansas that I knew. which is not the Delta. It's not the Ozark Mountains. It's not Little Rock. It's South Arkansas, just like this forested, you know, area. I wanted that to be in a movie, you know. And sure, I could have shot it in northern Louisiana and got some maybe some tax breaks or Mississippi or something like that. But yeah, one, I wanted my childhood sort of captured as much as possible. And I feel like it succeeds in that aspect, you know, to a point. I wish it embraced it even more. But you can only light up the woods at nighttime with so many lights, you know, before you run out of money. So we didn't have a whole lot of light to light it all up.
You made Come Morning for less than $50,000. And it, you know, it revolves around this grandfather and grandson who have accidentally shot the neighbor mm-hmm. and hiding the body and what happens next. Now, that's a pretty serious theme for a kid. And yeah. There's a child actor in the movie. How do you approach something like that? I've always wondered dealing with younger actors with adult themes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's very difficult. And I knew that. The reason I wrote it like that is because I'm interested in the theme of innocence lost. And so, you know, there's really nothing more innocent than a young kid. And that's kind of what Come Morning is about. Come Morning, what will become of this kid? You know, because when it starts off, the movie starts off, he's just a happy-go-lucky child. And the movie takes place in only like 15 hours or so. So it's kind of like what these 15 hours do to this child. And it's really tragic and sad. And so I knew going into it that, one, it was going to be very difficult to find a kid who can do that, because literally he's going to have to carry this entire film. And two, can I direct him to the point where he can deliver that? You know, first finding the kid, and then me as a director, can I, you know, do that? But it took a long time. We saw so many kids, and we ultimately found Thor, the boy in the movie, Thor Walstead. We found him in Florida. And he sent us a video audition. And when I saw his first go at it, I was like, wow, this kid has something. I don't think you can call it anything. It's just, maybe it's intuition. I don't know. He just has something about him that whenever I was like, you know what? He's really good. And we were shuffling around, you know, probably three or four different actors at the time. It probably took us 6 or 7 months to cast that one role. But I think we auditioned him 3 times, and there was just something about him, like a maturity that's uncommon for a 10 or 11 year old. And Thor hadn't had any tragedy in his own life or anything like that. You know, he still had both of his parents. He didn't know death or anything like that. But I guess it's that maturity that allowed him to kind of go to that place in his mind and deal with it. And two, Come Morning's a bit of a commentary on masculinity too, and like not showing as much emotion as perhaps what would be expected. But so that was something else too. I had to tell him, you know, hey, listen, we don't always cry when we're really sad. You know, we're not always, you know, this or that. And he caught on to it really well. He did a great job, and a lot of people comment about how, you know, he's sort of the backbone that kind of holds it all together. Because at a certain point in the movie, it just becomes about him and like what's going to happen to him, and I think he pulls through in the end.
What do you hope people will take away from seeing the film? Any sort of lesson that you're trying to get across to your audience?
Well, is there a lesson in Come Morning? Oh, there's definitely a lesson. That's not why the movie was made, of course. There's
sure.
There's no agenda there, but agendas have been questioned out of it. At Oxford, someone said, you know, is this a commentary on gun control? And I said, it was never meant to be a commentary on gun control. But at Oxford, that was in February of this year. A couple months before was the Newtown school shootings. And so it was a really hot topic right then. And I said, well, you know, I wrote this movie 3 years ago. So, you know, I wouldn't have foreseen that. But no, it's definitely not a commentary on gun control. It could be seen as that, perhaps. But I just mostly see it as a commentary on masculinity and the stupidity of man, not mankind, man, you know, and sort of this idea of you have to be tough. You can never sort of fess up for something that you did, you know, and how a stupid decision, like, you've got to be a man, you've got to be tough, something as mundane as that can ruin someone's life, you know, even if it was never the intention. The whole story is sort of the ruining of this boy, you know, his innocence. And a lot of people said, you know, what happens after the story? Because Come Morning gives you all the answers. It's a complete movie. But in the end, it kind of leaves you with, oh, I wonder what's going to happen now, you know? And it's not necessarily a pleasant feeling. You're just kind of like that. It's just like this silence at the very end. You watch it and the fades out and it goes to credits. And you're just kind of like, huh. But I wanted that. Like, I like that. The Coen brothers are a big influence on me. And I like how at the end of a lot of their films, it just stops and you're like, huh. You know? Come Morning doesn't just stop like that. I mean, it comes full circle. And I purposely did that, too. I could have just stopped it, you know. But you feel like you have enough answers to the question. But at the same time, it leaves a lot of room for thought in more ways than one, too. It's ambiguous in particular areas and whatnot. And a lot of times, I think, if you watch it again the second time around, you pick up on more, you know, information. Because I intentionally, you know, leave some things ambiguous. I intentionally only say people's names once, if at all. You know, it's kind of like you really have to listen. It's just a movie. You have to sit down, be patient, and listen. And you'll be taken on the ride, you know, and perhaps enjoy it.
That was Derek Sims, the writer and director of Come Morning. He stopped by KUAF late last week. Come Morning will be shown at 7 p.m. December 5th at Rogers Malco Town Cinema. Tickets are $10 and they can be purchased at the door or at comemorningrogers.brownpapertickets.com. Blu-ray and DVDs of the film will be for sale for $20 before and after the screening. More information is available at fabledmotionpictures.com.
It is Tuesday, November 19th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I would suggest a road trip, but Antoinette's probably got them all lined out. I'll hand my notes to her.
I mean, I'm going out of town this weekend.
See? There you go. Well, if you're going out of town this weekend, here are some suggestions. Rain, in case you missed it, at the Walton Arts Center. We'll be at the Music Hall at Fair Park in Dallas this weekend. Tickets start at $20. Also in Dallas, if you missed him, B.B. King will be on stage tomorrow night at the Winspear Opera House. If you're in Little Rock, on Thursday, Willie Nelson and family will be at the Robinson Center Music Hall.
But they're also going to, although if you don't have tickets,
sold out
to Walton
here.
Arts Center, yeah.
December 7th, Jimmy Buffett at the Verizon Arena. I've really got to talk to a friend of mine about that. And in St. Louis on November 24th, Elton John at the Heifetz Arena.
All right.
So there's some road trips for you.
Thank
Got
you.
Any of those planned?
No, but I'm sure I can work them in.
Okay, there you go. I'll leave the list.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. As Paul Harvey used to say, time for some shop talk. There are changes that are taking place at KUAF and KUAF 3. Our operations manager is Pete Hartman. He will explain everything now. Pete, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
First of all, HD3, or what we now call KUAF3,
That's
which
right.
is available over the air with your KUAF HD radio or online at KUAF.com, undergoing a few changes over the past few weeks.
Or with your iPhone using the KUAF app, or
yes.
with your Android using the NPR app. Many ways you can reach that, but yes, I guess we might want to back up, kind of explain the Diane Rehm Show, just in short,
okay.
for those who haven't. The Diane Rehm Show was on KUAF3, 9 to 11. Kind of along with a package deal from NPR. NPR went up in price on this package deal. We thought we wouldn't be able to get it, so we dropped all of them. We heard from quite a few listeners about specifically the Diane Rehm Show. Rick went to NPR and said—
Rick being Rick Stockdale, our general manager.
said, okay, is there any way we kind of step outside the package? Can we just have Diane Rehm show for X amount? And NPR said, you bet you can. So the Diane Rehm show is back on KUAF3. That's 9 to 11, Monday through Friday. We have just recently added, as you know, Ozarks at Large can now be heard Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. Then after that on Mondays, Sound Medicine can be heard at 6. Tech Nation can be heard Tuesdays at 6. We feature Big Picture Science, which used to be Are We Alone? Still the same program, you know, but they did change their name. Big Picture Science can be heard Wednesdays at 6. Then on Thursday evenings, Planetary Radio begins at 6, a great program, followed by at 6:30, Encounters, radio expeditions from the North. What is that? I got to tell you. I personally believe Encounters is one of the best unknown programs that KUAF is airing. His name is Richard Nelson, the host of this program. He goes out on the tundra with a microphone, and he basically, I'll just describe the last episode I heard. For about 20 minutes, he describes what he sees. From the peregrine falcon to the moose over here, and you're hearing these things.
Oh boy, look at this. Our deer has decided it's going to lay down on this soft bed of kelp, looking straight toward me, ears up, hearing my voice, but looking pretty darn relaxed. Imagine the relief and pleasure that a deer like this one must experience after this winter snow melts and the new plants start to appear in the springtime. Those bony, ridge-backed deer can start regaining their strength, start regaining their weight.
Do not think for a moment boring, because that 30 minutes is going to be gone before you know it. And you realize, oh, all he did was describe a moose eating. Yeah, well, he kept your attention. It's a really neat program.
Okay. And then Friday night at 6?
Friday night at 6, Philosophy Talk, another great program. That's an hour long. And these two guys, it's hosted by two gentlemen. Each week they just, as you can see, Philosophy Talk. They talk about philosophy.
The problem is that our society is obsessed, I mean extraordinarily obsessed, with pedigree and prestige. I mean, deep in their heart of hearts, many people believe, I bet you some of the students in this audience believe, that the prestige of the college you go to will make an enormous difference to the rest of your life, an enormous difference.
You know, hardly anyone stops to ask whether that belief is true. But whether or not it's true, the bare fact that it's believed gives selective colleges and universities a perverse incentive to be even more selective.
Right, because people take selectivity as a signal of pedigree and prestige.
So that's some things that have happened on KUAF3. What is beginning this week is Fresh Air at 11 a.m. on KUAF3.
Now, to explain, Fresh Air, there's something in network radio that's called a feed. You
that's
can
right.
pick it up at different times. 11 o'clock is the first time Fresh Air is fed.
It's the first option anybody can air Fresh Air.
Right.
And now we're going to have it on KUAF3. Now,
that's never been an option for FM because we have classical music on at that time. Always
that
have
is,
had.
That is correct. And you bring up a good point. I think what we're starting to see here, even us at KUAF, because truthfully, for years, we've had this question, how do we use KUAF3? How do we use KUAF3? Well, I think we're starting to see that we have these options of either special programming or things that, quite frankly, we just cannot fit right now on the FM schedule. This KUAF3 is just an incredible option for stuff like that.
There are many shows out there in the public radio universe. If people have a favorite and they want to suggest it, can they email you?
Please do. Please do. I'm really and don't even think that, well, this isn't necessarily a national. It's just I've heard it one time. That doesn't matter. If you have heard something that for whatever reason makes you think, oh, man, that should be on KUAF, I'd like to hear about it. You can call me. My office number, 575-7714. Or, of course, like most people, I think I work best through email. And my email address, phartma@uark.edu. Of course, you can find all that at our website.
Just because someone likes a show, though, doesn't mean it can be at it. There's
that
cost.
Is true.
There's
that is true.
Some shows are not available to all stations.
Some
for
shows
various
are
reasons.
Maybe once per month, and it's kind of hard for us to format that within our schedule. But still, I love to hear from listeners because, especially with KUAF 3 in mind, we're only going to be able to offer you more and more stuff. And I think it's not just stuff to be on there either. These are quality programs that I think if you give a chance to listen, you're going to come back to.
Pete Hartman is the operations manager at KUAF. He's building up the brand new KUAF 3. Thank you, Pete.
Not a problem.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, we'll have an unusual music lesson with Keith Terry. He used to be a drummer. Now his instrument is his body. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Stay tuned to KUAF for today's Here and Now. It begins next after Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The Rogers Historical Museum presents Art from the Earth on exhibit now through February 2014. This exhibit features the museum's own collection, as well as other collections, to illustrate the wide range of pottery used, and sometimes made, in Arkansas over the centuries. Located in historic downtown Rogers, 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Gobbler.
Gobbler.
Yep. Gobbler.
Okay. No, I was just, where is Gobbler?
It is in Carroll County.
Okay.
In honor of Thanksgiving, because
sure?
Everybody's talking about Christmas, and while I love Christmas, just this reminder, we have not had Thanksgiving yet.
Yes, that is correct.
Yep.
So I want to say I heard some Christmas music yesterday, but it was for a good cause because it was the Bentonville Chamber Choir,
mm-hmm.
or members of the Bentonville Chamber Choir coming in to record inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio to help us get ready for their final Madrigal concert ever
right.
at Bentonville High School. That'll be on Friday, Ozarks at Large this week.
I'll allow it.
Especially because it's not Christmas music that you're going to recognize.
Sure.
This isn't something that's piped through at retail stores. It's not
right.
La, 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 la.
Okay.
So give me that leniency.
Okay. All you're, right, I suppose.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I share your...
Right.
Yes. You had some music in Furman Garner yesterday.
Yes. Joe Pug, one of the people who was on the main stage at Roots Festival this year, was back in town for a show at George's last night. And earlier in the afternoon, he stopped by the studio. We had a chat, and he played a couple of songs. And we'll have that on Ozarks at Large in a couple of weeks.
Mid-December, I believe.
I think so. I think we're looking at mid-December. But yeah.
All right. And you saw him last
night. I did.
At George's.
Went to the show last night. Him and his opener were both very good. Sarah Cahoon, I think, was her name. Mm-hmm. And they were both very, very good. Small for, Monday night crowd. What do you
right.
do? So George's moved it to their front, smaller stage, which is nice because I enjoy those more intimate concerts.
Sure.
And I think sometimes it depends on the artist, but I think that particularly works well. Singer-songwriter works well with an intimate audience. And I think they enjoy it, too. So.
I spent some time in Salem Springs last night at 28 Springs Restaurant.
Mm, sounds good.
Where I made butter.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
Sure.
They had it all started.
Well, sure.
Right. And that will be on a later edition of Ozarks as well, too.
Okay.
All right. Plenty to come.
Yes.
On Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Antoinette will be with Christina tomorrow
mm-hmm.
for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. And then Christine and I on Thursday. You and I will be back on Friday.
That's the plan.
Thanks so much for listening.